Imagine for just a moment who might say of their work, it's deeply spiritual. Who might say that? It's deeply spiritual. Who would explain that their work is often led by opening prayer? Who would attest that in their work, people build altars? Any thoughts about who you think would offer such statements and what they might be talking about? Who might urge us to follow Goddess, God, Spirit, love, healing, transformation? Who might attribute their capacity to be deeply engaged to an intentional spiritual practice? And then describe their deep engagement as itself being spiritual. In 2013, George Zimmerman was acquitted on murder charges in the death of Trayvon Martin. Three black queer women, Patrice Cullors, Alicia Garza, and Opal Tometi, offered a response and then a platform for other responses and then a protest that morphed into a movement called Black Lives Matter. The social media they were able to tap into and then activate the rage felt among many young blacks and others, initially targeting their actions and on-the-street protests as responses to police-involved shootings. The source of the quotes with which I began, the person who said that their work is deeply spiritual, often led by opening prayer where people build altars, was Black Lives Matter co-founder Patrice Cullors. That spiritual, prayerful work is the engaged activist protest movement now known as Black Lives Matter. Things aren't always as they seem. Or put another way, what we look at and what we see, what we assume and what is actually the case may vary widely. Consider then the life, perspective, the engagement of one Henry David Thoreau. To the extent to which many of us know Thoreau at all, it is probably through having read his best-known book, Walden, more likely by assignment than by choice. Thoreau, the hermit, the loner, the wanderer in the woods who shunned human contact and removed himself as far as possible from the affairs of human society. It's more than a stereotype. There's plenty about who Thoreau was and about what he wrote that confirms that image. I am made to love the pond and the meadow as the wind is made to ripple the water, he'd write early on in what would turn out to be his voluminous journal. What business have I in the woods, he'd ask himself, if I am thinking of something out of the woods? It's the marriage of the soul with nature that makes the intellect fruitful, he'd profess, that gives birth to the imagination. And in his own explicitly spiritual testimony, Henry David Thoreau would attest, my profession is always to be on the alert to find God in nature. Though his actual sojourn in his cabin at the pond outside Concord was but a brief chapter in his life, to those woods and others he would retreat almost every day. There, in his quite intentional form of spiritual practice, Thoreau would come to understand himself most deeply in a transcendental relationship with nature. Though raised in the local Christian Unitarian Church, as an adult, he would thoroughly reject it, declaring of it in one of his many derisive statements, "If it were not for death and funerals, I think the institution of the church would not stand longer." What he found within Concord's Unitarian Church was deadly. What he found out in Concord's environs fed and filled his soul. And that, then, is Thoreau. Only it isn't. Such a depiction of Henry David Thoreau is, as my friend Galen Gingrich is fond of saying, 100% half right. Thoreau, in truth, was actually deeply concerned about the social order. He decried one form of social justice, injustice, and another, regarded the government with unrelenting suspicion, spoke out against various forms of oppression, sought to use his voice and his influence to effect change. There's no clearer example to be had of this impulse than in Thoreau's regard for the radical abolitionist John Brown. Brown earned his reputation as an armed combatant against slavery in Kansas. But it is his organization of the raid on the armory at Harper's Ferry that he'd secure his place in our nation's history. They are backed by funding from other abolitionists, including at least a couple of prominent Unitarian ministers. Brown tried to launch an armed, violent uprising intended ultimately to undermine the institution of slavery. Captured and tried, Brown's life ended on a gallows in a Virginia field with, among many others, Stonewall Jackson and John Wilkes Booth looking on. As you may know, Brown's legacy remains a source of historical debate. Some liken him to a terrorist, dismissing any potentially positive intended ends by decrying his violent means. Others are more accepting, even adulatory, regarding him, in the words of biographer David Reynolds, as the man who killed slavery, sparked the Civil War, and ceded civil rights. Such acclamation is surpassed significantly by Thoreau's acclaim. The walker in the woods took to the podium in Concord to declare before his fellow townspeople his spirited approbation. Brown was, he'd proclaim, a man of rare common sense and directness of speech, as of action, a transcendentalist above all, a man of ideas and principles. Chiding his disapproving neighbors, Thoreau would insist, "Though you may not approve of his methods or his principles, cease to call names, to cry, 'Mad dog!' The method is nothing. The spirit is all in all. It is the deed, the devotion, the soul of the person." So utterly abhorrent was slavery to Thoreau that all methods, including armed insurrection, were acceptable, understandable, even admirable, if they aided in the cause of abolition. It was his peculiar doctrine, Thoreau would say of Brown, that a person has a perfect right to interfere by force with the slaveholder in order to rescue the slave. And Thoreau would add, "I agree with him." Listen to just how clearly Thoreau spelled it out. "When a government puts forth its strength on the side of injustice as ours to maintain slavery and kill the liberators of the slave, it reveals itself as a merely brutal force, or worse, a demoniacal force, elevating his estimation to something almost messianic. Henry David Thoreau would proclaim of John Brown, "I would rather see a statue of Captain Brown in the Massachusetts State House yard than of any other person whom I know." Now, we must not be misled. Thoreau, Emerson, Theodore Parker, Bronson Alcott, others of their transcendental ilk, so despised slavery that even violence was acceptable in the name of abolition. However, we must not equate their position with any kind of meaningful attack on our nation's long history of white supremacy. Each of these men said horrific, abominable things about the race of enslaved Africans. There's absolutely no case to be made of them that they believed in racial equality. They did not. Their utterly white supremacist attitudes are a blight on our nation's history. And to the extent to which we wish to claim any of them as our Unitarian forebears, a serious mar, exemplifying our own long investment in that worldview. That said, for today we can at the very least find fodder for reflection in Thoreau's full-throated embrace of Brown and his tactics. What means are acceptable? What means are excusable? What means might we use in the fight against injustice? What gets labeled as violent? And what violence gets excused in the name of keeping order or of protecting and serving? Whose lives matter? And just how much do they really matter? A man some think of as only a solitary hermit in the woods, gazing deeply into both a pond and his own soul, was also a fierce and unforgiving critic of the social order and of the status quo. From the meditative solace of woods walking spirituality comes a figure using his voice and influence to challenge the assumed order of things and in his own way to sound the call for transformation. He'd write, I do not complain of any tactics that are effective of good, whether one wields the quill or the sword. But I shall not think that one mistaken who quickest succeeds to liberate the slave. Things aren't always as they seem. Or put another way, what we look at and what we see, what we assume and what may actually be the case, may vary widely. Patrice Cullors, artist, activist, organizer, Fulbright scholar, freedom fighter, Black Lives Matter co-founder, has just published a book entitled When They Call You a Terrorist, a Black Lives Matter memoir. In it, she writes, I'm beginning to see that more than a single truth can live at the same time and in the same person. I'm beginning to see that more than a single truth can live at the same time and in the same person. If that is true for an individual, for a spiritual practitioner turned street protester, for a silent saunterer turned vocal gadfly, how much more so for a group of people? What are we about? What is the meaning of this place? Here we are called, we are challenged, we are inspired to discover deeper spiritual meaning. We're invited to attend with attention to our own personal, inner, deep spiritual lives. But that's hardly our only truth. Here, too, we are called, challenged, inspired to become, in the words of our board's call to action, a more outwardly directed faith community, working with others who share a vision of a more just and equitable society. We're invited to attend with attention to the deepest truths about our nation's long investment in white supremacy and to ask hard questions of ourselves collectively, of our larger community, of our social order. Here we are challenged, troubled, disturbed, discomfited to deepen our understanding of systemic injustice and inequity. We are those grounding ourselves spiritually and creating bold new possibilities of investing ourselves in the work of societal and environmental transformation. We're those who understand that spirituality doesn't always, shouldn't always take the form of personal meditation and quietude, our own kinds of walking in the woods. Sometimes, like colors, like those Black Lives Matter activists, we must be those praying in the streets, building altars right in the very struggle against injustice. Where, my friends, is our Walden? Where will we find a place to renew our hurting souls? Where? Where, my friends, is our Harper's Ferry? Where will we find the right partners under whose leadership we can join as co-conspirators in the deepest, most difficult work in the freedom movement? In ever more profound ways, some of us are coming to see that more than a single truth can, should, must live here among us. We, hearing the earth call, feeling that deep power, we, appealing to reason and compassion and conscience and vision, must work toward a transformed planet. We resist, we deny the false division between spirituality and social justice, understanding that while prayer can sustain action, prayer without action, spirituality without social justice, is but sounding brass and hopeless gain. Thoreau himself admitted, to give the within outwardness, that is not easy. But in these times, it is essential. We're being called to Walden, to walk the woods of spiritual sustenance and to care that those woods remain protected. But we're also being called to Harper's Ferry, to ask, for example, why environmental disregard and devastation so unfairly imperils the lives of those who are already marginalized by injustice and inequity. We are being called Do you hear? Do you hear?